Hi, everyone. I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
it's good to be back. I was here maybe about a month ago, and so it's good to see some familiar faces. Thank you, Billy, Lynn, and Sam, Jim, everybody for welcoming me. Matt, thank you, guys. And I will tell you that this morning was really great because I had my home group meeting to kind of give me a boost. So I'm asking God to just go first today because he's in charge. So hopefully, you know, that will happen. And I'm not going to share from here. That'll be from here. Because what's here is not good. So my sobriety date is December 3rd, 2003. My home group, as I said, is this morning. It's 9:30, Awakenings Group, Sunday mornings at Johnston Willis. And I'm active in service at the area level and the home group level, which is very important for me to keep coming back and stay connected. And I have a sponsor as well. So now that we've got all that out of the way, that's really important for me to hear, though, because when I got here, what do? You know, I'm here and I see all these people and they look really busy and they look happy, but how do I get that? You know, so it was really important for me to have women surround me and take me under their wing and tell me, you know, you need to get a sponsor. You need to join a home group. I spent so much of my life feeling separate, you know, and this was the only place that I found that I could come where I could feel a part of and really feel connected, and I thank you for that. There was something here that I didn't find anywhere else. There was something here, the identification. There was the, you know me and I know you. We've never seen each other before, but the way that you think and the way that you feel and the way that you describe it, I know that feeling and I know that thinking, and that is me. And, you know, I don't feel like contracts. I don't feel like agreements. I don't feel like therapy. I don't feel like anything outside issues helped me to find a spiritual solution like I found here. Now, that's not meaning to discount any of those methods. Those are outside issues. But for my alcoholism, I need a spiritual solution that is found in AA. Thank you for showing me. And I wanted to start off and show you or to read to you a page in the book that I just absolutely love. If I can find it. Okay. So a lot of times in my sobriety, it has been more painful for me in sobriety, the things that I've walked through, than things that I have experienced while drinking. And if you stick around long enough, that may happen. But there's nothing that can happen today that will justify taking a drink. There's nothing today that I know that a drink will make better. You know, it only gets worse. And so a lot of times I have repeated this to myself, and it just really helps when I'm in the really low spot or feeling depressed, sorry for myself, whatever. This is on page 8 of Bill's story. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, I always cried. That was to be the beginning of my last walk. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness and a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. And I have absolutely found that to be true. And, you know, I did not know that by giving back I would find usefulness and I would find my purpose and I would be fulfilled. I thought that by taking that was how I would feel fulfilled. And I'm a feelings person, so I always want to feel better. And that was what happened when I was growing up is, you know, I was raised by my mom. I had a brother. Still have a brother. He's younger than me. We're very close. And, you know, my mom's a single mom. My dad, my parents got divorced when I was 3. And my dad, I'm estranged from him, and he is in active alcoholism. I hope he finds these rooms one day. We're saving him a seat. But I grew up so completely uncomfortable in my own skin, and I did not know how to make that go away. I was climbing the walls, and I was clawing my skin, and I just wanted to rip my eyes out because it was just so painful to be me. And why? I don't know. You know, I grew up with everything I ever needed. You know, my mom always provided for us. I was, you know, I went to a great school. I had food, clothes, whatever I, pretty much whatever I wanted. And, but for some reason, I did not like me. And I never knew why. I did not know why. And, immediately from a young age, I can remember in elementary school, I needed something to change the way I felt. And what I found was that attention would give me a little bit of a high. So I would act out. I would do all kinds of things, whether it was like, I mean, I'm talking little, like drawing on the walls, or, you know, the teacher leaves the class and I stand on top of my desk and start singing. You know, I don't know why, but I know that that got me attention. And that took me out of the way I felt. That took me out of myself. And as I got into middle and high school, then what I started to discover is that I could, you know, it was the smoking cigarettes. It was some of the experimental substances. I got a hold of this thing called the Anarchist Cookbook, and it said that you could, if you scraped out the inside of banana peels and dried them out and smoked it, that you would get high. And I say that to let you know that even before I discovered alcohol, I still needed to change the way I felt. So, you know, it was those outside issues and just doing anything I could find. You know, we talk about leading the double life, triple, quadruple for me, you know, right here. And it was like my lifestyle looked like, you know, I was whoever you wanted me to be, but what group are you? Because if you are a jock, then I'm going to be a gymnast, you know, and fit in over here. If you are doing the goth thing, I'm going to go over there. And, so on one hand, you know, I've got this church group and I'm going to this youth group and I'm, you know, and I'm that. And then on the other hand, I've got this goth life where I've pierced my ears all up and down and, you know, the black and all that stuff. But I need to take that stuff off and take my earrings out when I go to gymnastics. So, you know, it's just really painful to be me. What do I do about that? You know, I don't know. And for so long, and I have a really active mind, and for so long I just thought that I was crazy. I really did. I went to so many doctors. I started therapy when I was 3. Nobody knew what was wrong with me because I was doing all these acting out things. They just wanted to fix me. And so that also, you know, that also turned into, you know, the dark phases of like the middle and high school days with the cutting and the poetry and the music to just escape and all that business. And then at 16, I got invited to a slumber party of all women, and I discovered alcohol. And I was everything I ever wanted to be. I was pretty, and I was funny, and I was whole. And I wanted that feeling for the rest of my life. And I had arrived, you know. And I thought, I know who I am now. I finally know who I am. And that was something that I would continue to search for and continue to chase until I got sober and found a higher power. And it's always like, you know, part of my story is also the, I love to connect with like the nomadic type. So I would go to these Grateful Dead shows and I really could identify with like the nomadic life with not having any possessions. And I really wanted to be that person. I really wanted to be the kind of person that could just travel the country and not have anything and just live off the land and just be happy with barefoot and all that stuff. And I just was too selfish to do it. I was like, you know, I need to take a shower and I need to look good. So I don't understand how you're doing this. But you know what it was is that with that kind of lifestyle, I saw something in that kind of lifestyle where somebody had found some sort of spiritual solution. Now, that was probably a psychedelic spiritual solution at that time. And, you know, so, but it was just, it's the searching. So, you know, I discover a drink at 16. I'm not sure if that was my first drink, but that was my first drunk. And one thing about women for me is women are difficult for me by nature, not anymore. But, you know, growing up, it's y'all are competition. And I never feel good enough. You know, I always feel less than. So I never felt like I measured up, and I never felt good enough to hang out with women. So, but this night, you know, I hung out with these women who accepted me, and I got drunk and was in the girl's closet naked, doing God knows what, on the phone with some guy that I was taking hostage on the phone, crying. And that's my drinking life. It's just like, you know, it's not pretty. It is not. And so anyway, talk about, you know, gross and incomprehensible demoralization. Oh, yeah. So thank goodness. Let me just say thank goodness that there wasn't Facebook back then. And like my sobriety, like at the end of my sobriety, cell phones started to be more of like a, you know, a commodity back then. It was kind of like, you know, a luxury to have a cell phone. And I was, you know, I love drunk dialing, and I did not understand if I was so excited to call you, how come you weren't excited to hear from me? You know, it's 3 a.m. and I'm so excited to talk to you. Why are you not happy to hear from me? And it's like, okay. And then I don't even remember doing that the next day, and I get, you know. So this drink, this 16-year-old. So the 16-year-old finds out who she is. But what happens is I have a good mom, and my mom knows what alcoholism looks like because she grew up with it and she was married to it. So she told me from a young age, you know, you're probably an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, yeah, blah, 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 whatever. I'm never going to be like that. And I don't know what that was, but I wasn't going to be like that. And so I had that drunk, and then that was kind of really the last way. And also I want to say, too, that I knew that I could not drink the way that I wanted to while I was living in my mom's house. And that's, you know, I don't know that I had those words to put to it back then, but now when I think about it, it was like, you know, even then I wanted to get away in order so that I could do that like I wanted to. I knew that there was something wrong with me that, you know, I had to have more. I had to have more. And so I'm doing the other things. I'm continuing to do the other things until I go away to school. And I went to this wonderful college. It's called Longwood, and I call it Shortwood because I was only there for one semester. And they did not really appreciate the fact that I did not care to go to class, and all I wanted to do was drink and, you know, cause corruption. Before school even started, I was in the water fountain, in the fountain outside of the dining hall, swimming. I just moved in, you know, like I said, I think school started maybe 2 days later, and up strolls campus police. It's like midnight. I've got no clothes on once again in the fountain, and that's not really a good look. So, you know, and here's the thing is, that began my career of blackouts, and I never knew that blackouts were only special to us, you know. I thought that everybody blacked out, and I thought it was so amazing to do all these things and wake up wherever, and then everybody would laugh, and I would have a great story, you know, and everybody would think, you know, the bigger and the more grandiose the story was, the more crazy things I did, you know, the more attention I got, and that made me feel good about myself. And So, my sponsees and I were talking in the car about the poor case with Hannah Graham, and my mom asked me recently, she said, you know, what was she thinking? You know, what was she thinking about walking alone that late at night? I was like, you know, Mom, do you know how many times I did that? Do you know how many times we all did that? You know, and I don't know why that didn't happen to me. I don't know why, you know, I woke up in a lot of sordid places, hotel rooms, lots of places where my mom and my brother would come pick me up, and it was humiliating, you know, for them to see that. for them to go pick up my mom to pick up her daughter and my brother to see his older sister in a hotel room without having any idea, alone, not knowing how I got there, what happened, what I did, and I could not piece any of it together. But you know what? I can't stand that emotional hangover that I have the next morning, so I got to put more booze on it to take that feeling away, to take that edge off. And that's the thing, is like, you know, I will not drink today. I promise I won't drink today because of what I did last night. I don't know what I did, but I know that, you know, I don't want to go anywhere, and I'm paralyzed by fear because I don't know if who I pass on the street or in the store. I don't know what I've done to you. And my friends are becoming fewer and far between. The places I'm allowed to be at, you know, are becoming fewer and fewer. And I'm absolutely paralyzed. And, you know, I take a drink, and then all that goes away, and I feel better, and it's on. And so my drinking was a lot of I like to play games with myself. And I like to think that I'm smarter than everybody else in the way that, you know, the kind of games that I played with myself was, I'm not an alcoholic if I drink martinis with olives. I'm not an alcoholic if I go to this high-class bar and wear this fancy clothing, drink with this fancy man, and, you know, all this fancy stuff, surrounding myself with all this luxury so that I don't have to feel like I'm an alcoholic. But let me tell you, I did not wake up in fancy places, like I said. No matter how I tried to dress up my drinking, I couldn't. I could not. The fact of the matter is that I am an alcoholic, and I can do whatever I feel like I need to do to try and convince myself that I can solve my problem, and I just can't. The ways that I have tried, and I can't ever say, you know, I can't really ever tell you that that I tried different methods to stop my drinking. What I did try is different methods to feel better and try and take the edge off. And what that looked like for me was, let's try exercise. Let's try food. Let's try shopping. Let's try work. Let's try relationships. Let's try pills. Let's try, you know, you name it, self-help books, religion, you know, you name it. It was just, I tried it and it just didn't work. I had one night where I went to Georgetown and woke up the next day and, you know, in the emergency room I had alcohol poisoning, which is funny because no matter how much I didn't want to drink the day before, I had signed a contract with my therapist and my family that I would have 3 drinks, and I did, and then I had more. And, you know, it's like, the promises, the telling you, I'll stop, you know, that just, you know, it never worked. I'm a huge seeker of, you know, the human power solution. So I have tried relationships in and out all over the place to try and fix me. And what that looks like for me is I have exhausted that completely. If you want to talk to me about, don't do what I did, please. I had 4 rings on my, but by the time I was 30, I had 4 different rings on my finger, engaged to 4 different men, not because I was drinking, because I was sober and because I didn't have a spiritual solution. And I did not understand that no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. You know, I just need something. You take the drink away from me and I'm crazy. I'm absolutely crazy. You know, I try to just get here and just be physically abstinent, physically sober. And, that did not work for me. When I was maybe 21, 22, I woke up and, one morning, and it was just like any morning. I woke up, and I wasn't really sure where I was, who I was with, how I got there, and how to get out. And it was kind of a feeling, when I used to wake up in the morning, it was kind of like I would open my eyes, and then I would kind of be afraid to move, because it was like if I moved, then it was a reality. It was almost like if I could just stay asleep forever, then none of this around me would be happening. As soon as I moved, then I was in the real world and it was reality. But anyway, so I wake up. It was really just like any other drinking day, but for some reason, you know, I'm going to get sober today. And so I go home. I look in the phone book. I look up Alcoholics Anonymous, get in a group, and go to the 7:30 a.m. meeting the next morning because I'm going to do this. So I'm going to go at 7:30 in the morning. And there were people that had open arms. There were people that were welcoming me. There were people that clapped when I got a white chip. And it was wonderful. I loved the attention, you know. And that's the thing is that that's what I did for 11 months. And I did not listen to you when you told me to get a sponsor or work the steps or get a home group, a service position, blah, 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 blah. And I am sober, and I'm going to let everybody know how great I am. So, you know, I'm working at a bar at the time, and, you know, no, I'm sober. I'm not going to taste the wine. I'm not drinking. I'm sober. But yet, for some reason, I find that it's okay for me to go over here and take the edge off with other things because I'm not drinking, you know. So I think I'm sober because I don't have the guidance of a sponsor and you guys. So, you know, I'm going to this meeting on a fairly regular basis, and they have the steps up on the wall like you all do. And I see 1, 2, and 3, and I'm like, yeah, yeah, I know. Yep, alcoholic. And then I skipped 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and went to 9. And I would also like to mention that I have also tried geographic changes as well, the geographical cures. When I was drinking, I moved to Nag's Head, and that whole thing lasted 2 months before I had burned every bridge and nobody wanted me there, and I couldn't even go to where I was living because I wasn't welcome. So I did that to live like the beach bum life, because if I had that kind of lifestyle, then it was acceptable for me to drink how I wanted to. And the thing about me, too, is that I don't like to drink alone. So I got this credit card, and I don't want to drink by myself, so can you please come with me, and I'll pay for all your drinks. And you too, because the more people I have, the more it justifies my drinking. And I just can't do it alone because then, you know, I'm an alcoholic. So I go to the 9th step. And I go straight to an ex-boyfriend, and I apologize to my ex-boyfriend and tell him I'm sober. And we get back together. And the way that my thinking and my amends unguided is that amends ended up with a ring on my finger, you know? And it's like, that is what happens when I come up with these ideas. And I'm really good at forcing things, and it's like, you know, really good at if I just try harder at this. And I love in the 11th step in the book where it talks about, you know, that we're free from excitement, fear, worry. And I didn't understand that excitement was bad, you know, and I just wanted to fix everything and try harder. And so I was free from alcohol for 11 months. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Did not have a spiritual solution, was not doing anything. What happened? I drank again. You know, it's no surprise to you guys. It was a huge surprise to me. It was not better. It was not better. So on this little bout of drinking, I decided that my new thing was going to be climbing the fences of hotel pools and going swimming by myself at night. I don't know why. I like to break into places, too, and by myself and just do, you know, I stole stuff just because I could steal, you know. I remember one night I went to this bar concert, and the bar had, like, a whole bunch of trays, like cafeteria trays, and I stole as much as I could take. And then I got out in the parking lot, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with these, and just chucked them. Why do I do that stuff, you know? So it's just craziness. I do not have good ideas. So I'm doing all this business. Like I said, I do not know why I did not have any legal consequences. I do not know why I did not end up with more beaten than I was. But let me tell you, I had no soul when I got here. I was absolutely empty and defeated, broken, ugly, absolutely ugly. I had no idea how to do this. And, you know, the last night of my drinking, the next morning, my mom, I was living back with her, and she was done. She had had enough. And she said, you know, you either get help or you get out. So, I went to detox for 5 days, and then I was fortunate enough to be able to get into a treatment program. And I'm real quick to identify out because, like I said, I did not lose anything material. But I didn't have anything material. I had no home. I had no car. My mom owned my car. I had nothing, you know. And so, but, you know, if I want to, I can identify myself out just like this. And so when I first got here, it was very difficult for me to identify with people who were talking about the things that they lost, because I could not hear that they were talking about the absence of a spirituality, the stripping of any sort of self-worth. So I spent a lot of my drinking, like I said, if I just make everything look perfect on the outside, then y'all won't have any idea with how I'm doing, how badly I'm doing on the inside. I wanted to die when I got here, but I wasn't brave enough to kill myself. I had a vain attempt at, you know, an overdose when I was 18, which ended up in the hospital having my stomach pumped. But I don't even know, that was probably an attention seeker. And when my mother offered me the ultimatum of either you get help or you get out, I was so grateful. Because I wanted help very badly, but I was too prideful to admit that I wanted it and to accept help without that sort of ultimatum. And I put conditions on it because, I mean, I can be, all this stuff can be going on, but yet I still have my pride intact for some reason. And that's a killer for me. And so I put conditions on it. So I'm like, you know, I'll go, but I need to have this, 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 and this for me. And part of those were like, I need to have my hairspray, and I need to have, like, you know, my clothes that I want. And, you know, Lauren needs this, and it's all about Lauren. And I'll only go into detox in the hospital if you give me my luxury items. So it's just ridiculous what I can conjure up in my mind. So, you know, because it's very important for me to maintain this image. And let me tell you also that that'll kill me really quickly, and I've done that a lot in sobriety too, where I think that if you guys see what I'm doing and I project this this image to you and I don't have to tell you what's really going on with me, that it's going to be okay. That almost killed me in sobriety. So I go to this inpatient facility, and I'm powerless over alcohol, okay? I got it. You know, I obsess over alcohol all day. Where am I going to get, you know, and I have to drink this much before I go to in public because they can't really know how much I'm drinking, and just plotting and planning and all that stuff. And I'm thinking about who am I going to manipulate? I'm out of money, so who am I going to get to help me out on that end? And I also will tell you that, you know, I was never a street lady, but I can absolutely tell you that I sold myself for whatever I needed. And I did not realize that until pretty far along in my sobriety, because I can convince myself that I don't do those things. But, you know, it's an arrangement. So I'm in the session at the treatment facility, and I'm powerless over alcohol. And once I start drinking, I can't stop, you know, and I don't know why. But I can't see how my life is unmanageable because I have everything. And then for some reason, I open up my wallet and out falls this BevNap is what we called it in the restaurant business. So it's a BevNap with lies written on it. And what I did was, because I was very calculating, I would, I had three different notebooks. I had one for family, friends, and my employer. And my intention was to write down my lies in the different notebooks and categorize them, because I couldn't have a conversation with two different people in the same room because it wasn't congruent with, you know, each other at all. So I can't even pick up the phone with somebody else in the room because then I can't keep it straight. And I got to keep these notebooks full of lies so that I can keep everything straight. But, you know, I couldn't take my notebooks with me. You know, when I would go out, and I really didn't take anything with me because I would lose everything. So so I would use these BevNaps and write my lies on them and then transfer them into the notebook. And that was my aspiration that day, I guess. So I open up my wallet, and out pops this BevNap with these scribbles on it of these lies that I need to tell these people. And I'm like, oh, okay, my life is unmanageable. Got it. So come back to Richmond. And still, you know, in treatment, my pride is intact, and I'm doing the most spoiled brat. I don't know where I learned this stuff. I act like a spoiled brat only child, and I'm not. My mom always said that I have this sense of entitlement, which I get. Like, that is totally me. I don't know where I have this sense of entitlement. You know, my mom is the most, you know, altruistic person I know, and she certainly didn't raise me that way. But so I was doing things in these meetings, like, you know, throwing chairs and saying, you're not giving me what I deserve, so I'm going to go somewhere where they will. You know, that kind of stupid princess stuff. And, you know, entitled, you owe me something, you know. And I didn't, you know, I have never really understood the concept of working towards earning something. I just always felt that I should always be given everything without earning it. And I thought that if I looked a certain way, then I could earn whatever I wanted. And, you know, so anyway, so I come home and I start to go to meetings, and I had a wonderful sponsor who took me through the steps. We went from the beginning of the book through page 173, line by line, word by word, and she made me look up stuff, and I'm like, I'm not stupid. I know what that means. But she's like, look it up. What is an avocation? Look it up, you know? And she took the time to do that. And she took the time, she gave me that time to really have me understand what every word in this book meant and why Bill worded it the way that he did. And so I was talking with one of my sponsees, and I'm thinking about the second step here, and the part about where it's talking about standing on the shore of what does it say? I don't know what page it's on, but you're standing on the shore. And, you know, I envision, it's in We Agnostics, and it's, I envision standing on the shore of, like, my mind, my reasoning, and then I cannot step ashore, you know, I cannot get over, and all you are saying, come on, this life is better, this is so much better over here, just do what we do, just have this spiritual fulfillment. And I'm like, nah, I got this, I can do it on my own. So I spent a lot of time with the whole, like, you know, the number two, where it's, you know, I did not believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and it's that, you know, that letter B, the, you know, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become manageable, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. No human power. And I tried that for such a long time in sobriety, and it should have worked. If it, you know, it should have worked, because I had every different plan, every different way of, you know, presenting things on the outside. And, you know, if we get this house and this car and you have this job and I have this job and we present ourselves like this, then we're fixed. And so what I ended up with was I was at the point, probably like 8 years in sobriety, I was at the point where I had gone through, I had been the tornado and gone through a lot of people, and I didn't know what to do. I was just stark raving sober. I was crazy, and I didn't want to drink. That solution was fortunately, you know, that obsession was removed from me early on. I did not have the desire to pick up a drink, but at 8 years sober, I had the desire to kill myself. My family was researching places to put me away. There was a place called The Ranch. I don't remember where it is, and it was a six-month program where they teach you how to live and how to function, and they wanted to send me away there. And it was like $60,000, and we didn't have that money to put me away there. And if we had that money, I went to the bank and tried to get a loan, and I wasn't approved. My credit is shot. Go figure. But, you know, had we had the money, I would have gone. And because I did not have a way of living. I did not have a design for life. I was not following what you guys have shown me. So 8 years sober, I'm going crazy. And I get a phone call, and it's somebody asking me to run a sober house. And, you know, the things that people have asked me to do here have kept me coming back, even though I don't want to do them. I did not want to go to that sober house and have to be in at 11 o'clock every night and make sure seven girls were not using and not drinking and drug test them and make sure they were getting their slip signed and be a good example and not spend the night out when I wanted to and not have people over and all this stuff. But I said yes. And around that same time, I was asked to be treasurer of Intergroup. And, you know, my character defects will help me and help you until they're not working anymore. Like, you know, I can pray for God to remove my character defects, but sometimes he lets me hang on to them because they're helping me. So my ego and self-seeking character defects, they propelled me to show up for that treasurer position. So, you know, I had to, it was all about looking good still for me. So the reason I didn't drink or kill myself at that time was because I had to show up for Intergroup. Because I said yes when somebody asked me to be of service. And so anyway, and that's what you guys have taught me. I've had great sponsorship growing up, and, you know, that's what they told me is it's action. And, you know, so I took a long time for me to grasp the concept of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. It took a long time because I felt like if I didn't run things, then it wasn't going to turn out the way I wanted it to turn out. You know, it's the opposite, totally the opposite. Let me tell you, I'm really good at manipulating and getting what I want. Look at where that's gotten me, you know, not good. Because, you know, I can get what I want, but the problem is that if my will is not aligned with God's, I'm defeated again. You know, I am absolutely beaten to a pulp. And here I am, you know, AA, here I am. You know, and it's a practice of turning over my will, my life, and aligning and understanding that it's going to be okay. And that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to have the perfect job, the perfect relationship, the perfect family, the perfect clothes, all that stuff. I could lose all that stuff tomorrow. But the thing is because of having a higher power and because of this fellowship and this program, I'm going to be okay. I have peace within me no matter what's going on. You know, there can be so much chaos going on around me, but you know what? I'm okay. And I've never known that before. The admission of my secrets, the revealing of the things that I've done that I was so ashamed of. Shame is a big part of my story. I've done a lot of things that I do not want to tell people about. And it has been just so freeing to believe that when I let go of these shameful things, when I share them with another alcoholic and in the presence of God and let them go and ask God to remove my character defects, it is freeing, you know. I can tell you about things that I've done, you know, in a constructive and helpful way. And because those things that I did in my past brought me to where I am, I did some terrible, terrible things. But because I've learned from them, I don't know if I would change any of it. I don't think I would. If I could go back and change anything that I did or that happened, I don't think I would, because I might not be here tonight. And I'm not going to mess with God's plan anymore. You know, with the ability to be able to immediately right things when I have wronged, I had a situation on Friday, actually, where I was on the phone with someone. This is somebody who is not in this fellowship. And we were just, you know, not having an agreeable conversation. And she was yelling at me, and I had to walk into this gas station. And I was yelling at her, shut up, shut up. You know, it's not nice. And there were people in the gas station. There was a gas station attendant there, and I bought a drink and didn't even acknowledge him and paid. And normal people can get away with that, but I left that and left the store, and it haunted me, and I needed to write that. So I went back to the gas station and went back to that to the attendant and said, hey, man, I totally disrupted your store. I was wrong. Is there anything I can do here to make it right, you know? And other people can act the way they wanted to. That woman on the phone, she can get away with treating me like that, but if I don't practice patience, love, and tolerance towards all, I'm drunk again. You know, maybe not tomorrow, but eventually. Being able to pause when agitated as well. So in the space between the pause of being agitated and the response, it's a reaction, it's a response, not a reaction today. And being able to say, thy will, not mine, be done in that pause. And then after having had a spiritual awakening, as doing these steps as provided in the big book, in order, being able to practice the principles in my affairs and help others, you know, what a gift. What a gift.
That is amazing to be able to have somebody who actually wants what I have, you know? I couldn't even look myself in the mirror when I came in, and now somebody wants to learn something from me and wants what I have, and it's not my car, my job, or my friends, but it's some sort of spiritual light that they see in me, and it's a connection. And you all have given that to me. I want to share a story with you, and then I'll close. So as a result of being able to be a productive member of society, I have found that I have a career in the mortgage business, and then I found that, you know, AA has given me a life, but it doesn't have to be
my life. So what that means for me is that go take it out into the world, you know? So it's not just live it in here and then walk out and then everything's whatever. I discovered that I could volunteer and I love animals, and I never thought that I could work in the field because I have worked in vet's offices growing up and I couldn't deal with it emotionally. It was very difficult. So I had just, you know, put that idea away and just resigned myself to the fact that I was just going to have to do something else. And so I began a career in sales and then now as a processor in the mortgage business. And what I discovered one day is, why don't I volunteer? I was having a conversation with someone and he was asking me, what my passion was. And I said, you know, it was working with animals, but I can't do that because it's too emotionally tolling for me and I just can't do it effectively. So then I was like, you know, well, I can volunteer. And, the next day after I had that revelation, and literally the next day I walked into this animal shelter, this local animal shelter, and was like, here I am. You know, like they should just be like, oh, wonderful, you're finally here. Come on. We've been looking for you because it's all about me, you know. But so I began volunteering at this animal shelter about 2 years ago, and so many great things have happened. I've been asked to be on the board of directors there. I've started a program that unites the dogs in the shelter with seniors at a retirement home that I do every other Monday. I'm active in coordinating a group on the second Saturday of every month that is 25 different rescue organizations in one venue, and I'm the media coordinator for that. And I don't say any of that. I don't get paid for that. I just love to do it. But I don't say that because out of pride. I say that because it's a gift. It's been given to me. One of the first dogs I fell in love with was this big black lab named Abe. And he was probably like 80 pounds, and he was all scarred up, and his ears were all tattered. And, he was just a love. And he was probably about five, we guessed, and when they neutered him, they found birdshot inside of his body. And, you know, we're not ever really sure what the animal's paths are when they get to the shelter. I don't know if I really want to know, but they're safe. And Abe and I formed a very special connection, and he sat there for a pretty long time, and people looked at him, and they came and they went, and this one family went, and she had two girls that she brought with her, and we talked, and I counseled her, and she said, well, you know, my husband's not really ready for a dog. We don't have a fenced-in yard. I also have a special needs girl at home, and, you know, we're just really not ready. We're just visiting. So I said, okay. And so she left, and I went about my business, and then you know, this was last winter, a couple winters ago. And so I put it out of my mind. A couple weeks went by. I walked into the shelter on a Friday night, which was my shift. And, of course, I went over to Abe's cage first, and it said adoption pending. And the family was standing there, and they had brought their special needs daughter and the father, and they took him home. And he started a new life. And the reason that I share that story with you is because I came in here just like Abe. I came in here scarred and broken and with damage on the inside and the outside, you know. But you all loved me anyway. You didn't care about my past. And you gave me a home and you helped me start a new life. And I thank you for my life.